Thanks everyone for sending in questions. We wanted to get through as many as we can. Sure. It's fair to say there's some that kind of fit in the same category, so we'll group them together and hope that you'll be satisfied with that. But we'll do as many as we can, and they're coming through thick and fast now. This topic, it's fair to say, lends itself to the odd question. So let's do our best here with this. Well, first of all, just sort of a summary question. I have a daughter. She's 14. What might she gain by continuing in the faith of her family? Might she lose something as well?
Wow, what an amazing question. Well, I think I would refer back to the wider cultural climate that we're living in, where young women growing up are living under that burden of objectification, I think in a more intense way than has been experienced by previous generations. And we can perhaps or certainly link some of the negative mental health outcomes for young women to that wider cultural phenomena. And so for me, Jesus Christ's words, "The truth will set you free," resonate with this issue. If it is true that women are image bearers, divine image bearers alongside men, that there's a sacredness, a givenness to gender, then I think that's an empowering philosophy for a young woman to grow up with and live with, that might be able to help or support that young woman resist some of the challenges that are out there in the culture. It's a counter narrative to the narrative today that speaks to a kind of ultra materialism that says other human beings are there for your consumption. You consume and then you discard. You consume and then you discard. And, you know, how do we resist that extraordinary cultural pressure and force? Well, ideas have consequences, at least beginning with correct ideas about what it means to be a woman, I think might be a help there.
Would you say then that Western culture, for all its sort of sense of setting women free, isn't actually as for women as we might sometimes like to think?
I think that there have obviously been different waves of feminism that have kind of achieved different landmark rights for women, I guess. And as I said earlier, the suffragette movement, that sort of passion for women to be able to vote and make choices, was really championed by Christians. Of course, it was resisted in some parts of the church as well. But the philosophical underpinning as to why, and even the language as to how to articulate that vision, drew very strongly on the biblical narratives. I mean, I certainly think today that in the last 5 years in particular, I think the internet's had a massive impact, but in the last 5 years, this increase in objectification has probably gone hand in hand with a massive increase in promiscuity and the idea that other people's bodies are there to be consumed and then discarded. I think that has taken hold in Western culture more rapidly in the last 5 years, and that's obviously very much countercultural to a biblical vision of the body and the dignity of persons.
Thank you. Despite your survey of how the scriptures can be reread as being more affirming of women than traditionally construed, surely an honest, even generous reading would at best conclude the Bible advocates a soft patriarchal ism. Does not its good news still lag behind modern feminist agenda?
Great question. I think that it is true to say that as you read the narratives of the Old Testament and as you read some of the Old Testament law and the societal construct of Old Testament society, that would be characterized by patriarchy. I mean, even the great leaders of that society are called the patriarchs, the great fathers. But we mustn't underestimate how radically countercultural in the equivalent era even the Old Testament texts are in affirming women as heroic leaders. Deborah, for example, was a national political leader who even led out in military battles. We mustn't underestimate the power of that statement that women pray directly to God and do not need a male mediator. I mean, everybody had a priest who sort of led worship, but women were able to pray to God just as men could. And that's why I think what I was trying to draw out about Jesus is so powerful, because into that context, into that sweep of history, Jesus comes and speaks to and about women in this extraordinary way, affirming the feminine in not just his teaching, but also in the kinds of roles that women were able to play. As I said, witnessing primarily, being the primary witnesses of the key events of Christianity, the incarnation, the atonement, and the resurrection.
The curse of Genesis 3 seems far more destructive and damaging for women. He will rule over you. This has been our history. How can this be explained?
I mean, I think one helpful way to read that text is to understand it as descriptive of the way things are. So the fall of humanity occurs as the result of people, male and female, exercising choice, and there are negative consequences that then come into the world. And there's a whole range of different alienations that roll in, different kinds of death. And one of those alienations is vocational. And out of the life experience of women, childbirth is going to be is described as a struggle, labour, as painful. Actually, that Hebrew word refers to the whole process of child rearing, not just the process of birth. So, the idea that the sense is that this is an accurate description of reality.
Has that been your experience?
It has, yeah. that humanity will experience different levels of alienation. And one of those experiences of alienation will be the battle of the sexes. I mean, you could say that Genesis 3 is a psychologist's dream. I mean, all sorts of the different alienations we face as human beings are very accurately described there as a consequence of the fall of humanity.
Okay. I grew up in a Christian family and also with domestic violence. When some of this came out a few years ago, the church leaders supported my parents rather than my sibling who made the accusations. Mm. How can young Christian women ever be expected to share their stories when this is a risk, particularly if their parents are in the church, and how can the church do better in this way?
Well, I would really like to thank whoever asked that question. I think it's an extraordinarily powerful point that you are making, and you are to be affirmed for raising that question. It is undoubtedly true, and studies have shown that this is a problem within churches as well as other hierarchical institutions. And historically, people who have viewed leadership as hierarchical and as a form of domination have found it very, very difficult to speak up for or to side with the victim. It's interesting to me, again, I think we need to go back to Jesus. Jesus Christ says that we in the church are not to lead as people in the world lead. Leadership is servant leadership. When Jesus wanted to demonstrate what it meant to be a leader, he got down and washed dirty feet. He took the role of a servant. And when we confuse leadership with domination, there are all sorts of perversions that come in, come into our experience. I was with the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. Some of you will probably have been following what's happening in the abuse scandals, not just in the church, but in almost every institution in society in Britain, from the football academies to schools and orphanages, to the BBC, where young people were sexually abused, and that was covered up for the predators by the establishment. And I was with Justin Welby a few moments after he had just spent some time with a victim's group who were sharing their stories of abuse that had happened within the context of either institutional church, sort of schools or homes. And he described, as he was speaking to those victims and saying what happened to you was completely wrong and completely unacceptable, and we want to put it right, and we believe you. He described the grey suits of the church hierarchy coming and trying to prevent him from saying that and trying to drag him out of the room to say, you know, for goodness sake, don't admit liability. Such and such diocese will go bankrupt. To which his response was, good. It needs to go bankrupt. We need to pay the price for what did occur. I hope that if you are a victim in this room, or if you are close to victims in this room, that you will hear that perpetration of abuse or cover-up of abuse is anti-gospel. It is totally an anathema to who Jesus Christ is. And to encourage you to find safe spaces to be able to speak about what your experiences are. And if you are a praying kind of person, to pray that the church, unlike some of the other institutions that we're all part of, would be able to step up to the plate and say, this did happen and this was wrong, and to pay the price for that.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks very much. Would you say that God transcends gender? Does his personhood contain both the essence of male and female? And this is getting complicated. Mm-hmm. Are the three persons of God male? And if so, why? This is the same question in less elaborate terms my 12-year-old asked me the other night. is the maleness of God a residue of patriarchy? This is a common question.
Sure. When someone asks you the question, what does God look like? I wonder what these mental picture that comes into your mind is. Perhaps elderly gentleman with long white beard in the sky, surrounded by fat cherubs on violins. For the Christian, the primary answer to what does God look like is Jesus Christ. God became flesh. God became human, took on human flesh in the person of Jesus Christ. So however we answer this question, and Jesus prayed to God as Father, that's clear. But at the same time, Jesus did invoke feminine metaphors to describe God. So however we understand this, I think it's important to say that God is not limited to gender. And that God, when he created humanity in his image, didn't say that one gender on its own could represent his image. As male and female, we are both image bearers of the divine. And that's a kind of picture of the unity and diversity of the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And so humanity and the unity and diversity of a male-female pair in some way reflects the image of God. So I think my answer would be that God transcends our categories of gender. But the image used in Philippians as Jesus is God incarnate, is this sense of kenosis, of self-emptying. And as he reveals himself in the world as a human being, it is as a male human being. And the words used primarily to describe God the Father are Father. So I hope a nuanced answer. And obviously there is some element of mystery to it, but that's what I'd say to that one.
Thank you. In view of Christianity's good news for women, how would you reframe its good news for men? or would you?
Is Christianity good news for men? I mean, I hope that some of the same arguments would hold. That Christianity is good news for humanity, both because there's this intellectual underpinning for the preciousness and dignity of life of the person, that there's an intellectual coherence to a vision for human flourishing, male and female. But of course, ultimately, Christianity is good news for human beings, because God deals with the reality of our experience. Christian faith isn't a kind of moralism where you're being asked to jump over X, Y, and Z hurdle, follow this rule, achieve this moral standard, and make yourself acceptable to God. It's the opposite of that, to recognition of our brokenness, of our filth, of our shame, of what the Bible calls sin, that fundamental alienation that has come into this world that all of us identify with. And it's good news because God doesn't say in Christianity, oh, just pretend everything's fine, ignore that, and put your church face on, be really, really good. We're actually met as we are, in our dirt, in our pain, in our brokenness, and we're forgiven, loved, invited into relationship with God. I think that's amazing news.
Time for a couple more.
Go ahead.
You okay?
Yeah. It's only about, I don't know what time it is in England. No. Can't think of that.
It's better not to.
Yeah.
Would you say biblical teachings on and church attitudes towards abortion are good news for women?
Again, I think that's a really interesting and powerful question. I don't know about the statistics here in Australia, but I'm sure you're aware of the global trend of sex selection by abortion. There are whole regions in the UK where they're making it either illegal or incredibly difficult to screen for gender in the womb because of this phenomena of aborting female fetuses. And I do think that it's an interesting challenge for the feminist movement today, which would obviously largely be championing the right of a woman to have an abortion, this question of, well, what about the rights of those female unborn children? I think Christianity has a lot to say on behalf of the weakest image bearers, of the vulnerable, and the portrait of the God of the Bible is that he passionately cares about that.
What advice do you have for women in the church? It seems to continue in some cases to be a place of patriarchy, intentional and sometimes unintentional diminishing of women. For women who are trying to make a difference in the church, what would you say to us?
I think my encouragement would be to keep that vision of God's kingdom, of the kingdom of God, of what leadership actually is. Because the temptation when one is a victim or has very negative experiences is to replicate those experiences and just do them back, just push back. So if one's experienced domination or verbal abuse, to fight back with the same. But the vision of Jesus's kingdom is that leadership is a kind of downward trajectory of service and love and forgiveness, love of enemies, not just love of friends, love of those we find extraordinarily frustrating. So my encouragement would be to hold on to that vision. But I think also to remember Jesus Christ and to go back to the original sources and to study what Jesus did and said, study what the texts actually do say about women, and form your theology and your action on that basis rather than on the basis of hurt or frustration.
There's a couple of questions around Paul and the New Testament. Yeah. The question of, is he a misogynist? You can't get into the whole detail of that now, but have you got just a brief response to that?
Yes. I mean, I find that very, very frustrating. I think it's a gross mischaracterization of Paul, who actually names and affirms all sorts of women in all kinds of different contexts, from Phoebe, who is the deacon, who he describes as pro-status, over the church in Rome, affirming this amazing woman, Phoebe, to Priscilla and Aquila. Priscilla, who has a teaching role with her husband, Aquila, to Philip's daughters who prophesy, to Lydia, who directly asks Paul, if you consider me a believer, will you let the church meet in my house? Why is that an important question? Because historically, whoever's home the church met in had a significant leadership role. And you see recorded in the book of Acts, Paul listening to Lydia, seeing that genuine Christian conversion and responding with the answer, yes, we will meet in your house. So I think it's a grossly unfair mischaracterization of Paul that he's a misogynist. Now, people have different views on a couple of passages. One would be in 1 Corinthians 14, where women are spoken of to be silent in the church. And there's a clear context there of disturbances, since earlier in the very same letter, Paul has said, when women prophesy, they should cover their hair, which was a kind of very alluring part of the body. So it was just saying, you know, be modest in church. So clearly women were not to be totally silent in church. Or 1 Timothy chapter 2, where in the Ephesian context, he says, I do not permit women to teach or have authority over men, and goes on to talk about women being saved through childbirth. My understanding of that text is that it doesn't cancel out everything else that Paul did and thought. And that actually, if you've ever been to Ephesus, I wonder how many people have ever been to visit, but the temple of the goddess Artemis was this extraordinarily huge and powerful and dominant force, just physically over the city, but also over every aspect of life. The worship was led and dominated by women. The women in the Ephesian church wouldn't have had a Jewish background. They wouldn't have known about Adam and Eve. So when they heard Paul's teaching about all sinning in the first Adam and needing the second Adam, they may well have been usurping authority. And Paul is saying, no, women, you need to learn. If you're following that kind of heretical teaching influenced by the Ephesian context, you can't have authority. So obviously there are others who would disagree with that interpretation, but I think however you interpret that, it would be an unfair characterization of Paul to say that he was a misogynist.
Okay, well, perhaps one last one. Yeah. You seem very upbeat about the Bible being for women. How hopeful are you that that message is able to get out today and to be heard?
Well, I think that the contexts that I go into, whether it be in universities or political settings or businesses and talk about theology and faith, overwhelmingly the people that I meet do not have a cultural Christianity. They have not grown up in homes where the Bible has been read or really thought about at all. And so, as I've been saying all along, I feel that whether we're completely new to this or whether we're old-timers in the church, when we face this kind of question, this sort of challenge, we need to go back to, what does the founder say? What does Jesus say? And for those who don't have particular preconceptions about that, they haven't got an inherited nominal faith, it's my belief and experience that when you actually do that, when you examine the original sources, when you examine the texts and they speak for themselves, and when you examine Jesus Christ, what you see, what you experience is overwhelmingly positive for women as well as for men.
Well, Amy, your talk was wonderful. Your answer to some very difficult questions was sensitive and wise. We're very grateful to have you here. Please thank Amy.
Thank you for having me.